You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the Art World Demystified.
Today we're talking with Richard Klein. He's the exhibitions director at the Aldrich Contemporary Art Museum. Richard, thanks so much for being with us today.
My pleasure, Brainerd.
To begin with, I'd like to ask if you could define what your role is at the museum. I want to talk about exhibitions you've been involved in, but can you outline what your role is at the museum for us?
Well, my title is exhibitions director, and I like to joke that it covers a lot of sins. I would say 60% of my job is curatorial, and 40% of my job is administrative. And the administrative part of it, I would say the bulk of it is in development, and particularly development on the exhibition side of the museum.
And development, you mean fundraising for particular exhibitions?
Fundraising for particular exhibitions and quite often general fundraising. If one works, you know, in the museum world and the nonprofit world in general, you know, more and more time is dedicated to fundraising. And a lot of what I do quite often is just, you know, meeting and talking to museum patrons and potential patrons, particularly people who are more on the art interested side, like the collectors, those sorts of people who might get involved in the museum in different levels, whether they're joining a committee, for instance, or literally, you know, writing us a check. And then
right.
Certainly a lot of the traditional development things such as grant writing.
And I suppose that there's also the areas of collectors getting involved specifically or patrons with certain exhibitions or certain specific projects of the museum as well.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny, just before this call, I came from a planning meeting where this topic was literally on the table. I was, you know, discussing it with my colleagues 15 minutes ago. And we're, you know, we had a meeting talking about next year, particularly the second half of 2014, and just going over potential funding sources for some of the exhibitions and everything from some deadlines for grants that are due early in the winter to you know, identifying potential sponsors for exhibitions. And it's everything, because we're a contemporary art institution, we're looking at a really broad spectrum, including galleries, because when we work with an artist, obviously the gallery has a potential, there's an advantage to the gallery in terms of exposure for their artists. And, you know, quite often we go out and, for instance, ask galleries to help us with advertising. We don't do a lot of paid advertising, but galleries quite often do. And to partner with them on advertising is a great way of, you know, spreading the word about what we're doing. So, you know, that it's not, you might not think of that as being traditional development, but it for us, it's a huge thing.
Sure. And I mean, and that's a slightly different paradigm than previously, but it's not nearly the commercial paradigm of museums like the Guggenheim or the Brooklyn Museum mounting, an Armani show or the Sensation show at the Brooklyn Museum that was essentially one person's collection. That doesn't seem to happen much at the Aldrich, as far as I know.
No, I think that's one thing about us that, you know, we have a reputation of really being very independent, and which is a very good thing in the contemporary art world. And we try to keep the process pure here, where we the projects we present, we present because we feel strongly about them and we think they're important. Once we've made our decisions, then we switch into development mode of saying, all right, we want to do this. And, how are we going to fund it or how are we going to support it? There are exhibitions we do which, you know, garner no support. And that's important that, you know, we're willing to take things on that that don't have the potential for bringing in significant money. And then, you know, there's things we do for audience development. I mean, that's another thing. I think now, especially with the rise of social practice and artists wanting to get involved in communities and community relationships and relationships with unusual organizations or community groups. It's a way of bringing new audiences and new individuals into the museum. And artists, you know, many artists like that now, where we're not just simply borrowing objects that are moved from point A to point B, but, you know, the artist is involved in the programming and working with the public in many cases. And frankly, that's the most interesting part of my job on the curatorial side. It's easy to borrow things, but when you're working with someone who really is engaged with the community in a major way, I think that's the thing that's fascinating. And also where, you know, I'm interested in when I take on a project of it being a learning experience where I learn something and where, you know, I'm going on a limb somehow. And those kinds of things where you're working with an artist to develop something new that involves the outside world, they're fascinating. That's the meat and potatoes of what I do.
Mm. Yeah, that's interesting because when I've talked to other people from different museums, curators, directors, they talk about the conversation that they'd like to have generated at the museum, and it seems that kind of community involvement that you're talking about does just that. As opposed to coming in and looking at a work of art, the kind of interactive educational resources, if I'm saying that correctly, generates a conversation between the audience and the curators and the artists. Is that correct?
Yeah, and just to it's interesting you're raising that question because we just did something here where, you know, traditionally in museums you have departments. You have an education department, you have an exhibition department, you have a development department. We just actually kind of combined the on one level, the education and the curatorial departments to form a new committee called the Programming Committee, where we're trying to look at exhibition programming and educational outreach and educational programming all together and really realize how related the two things are and not kind of isolate them, which really, when you talk about conversations, the conversations start when there are you know, particularly groups of people coming to the museum for various sorts of programming. I mean, certainly individuals come and talk to each other when they're here, but it's community events, and it's everything from a informal cocktail reception on the first Friday of every month we do here to, you know, a more traditional panel discussion where we have people, artists and others, come and talk about a topic. Those are where the conversations start, and it's really an alliance between curatorial and education in terms of strategizing what sorts of programming we could do that's really, you know, unusual and will garner the most public attention.
And is it typical that artists ever propose those kind of educational initiatives, or, you know, are they always kind of curated or brought in? I'm wondering whether local artists or lesser-known artists can get involved in those kind of activities. Does that happen as well?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Art. I mean, well, first of all, we love artists that have interesting ideas for public programming, because we try to involve artists in as much of the programming as possible here. Because we're a contemporary art institution, and contemporary art we define as you just have to be alive to be a contemporary artist. The advantage we have is having the artist come and hearing the voice of the artist, whether it's a video that might be posted on our website where they're talking about their work or actually them organizing a program here. We have artists on all different levels. I mean, we have artists that don't exhibit here involved in our programming. We have a program now that's going to be 13 years old, called Draw On, which is a drawing festival, a yearly drawing festival that takes place in March, which now involves other institutions inside the state of Connecticut and even outside the state of Connecticut. And for that program, which is, like I said, it's 4 weeks, we bring in artists to run programming of various sorts that aren't involved in our education program, I mean, our exhibition program specifically. So there's a mix. In terms of the public conversations, there's a mix of artists we exhibit and artists we don't exhibit.
It's exciting. It's always been one of my favorite museums for a number of reasons, but partly because I'm between New Haven and New York, and so are you. But also how the contemporary artists that you bring in there seem to to be able to do things that I don't usually see in other museums. And I know these were a while ago, but I'm thinking of the Anselm Kiefer small building that was out there, and a number of things that just seem to be really ambitious and something that other museums couldn't do. I mean, even things on the grounds outside, really kind of something that, PS1 MoMA would be envious of, to have that kind of, it seems, flexibility to produce things that are very exciting and aren't just, typical in-the-box kind of exhibitions.
Well, you mentioned the institutions in New York, and the one advantage we have is that, as you say, we're near New York City. We're in, if you drive from Manhattan, we're a little over an hour from Manhattan here. So we're close enough to New York to be involved in the dialogue that goes on in New York City, and for people in New York to be aware of the museum, certainly. And I would say, probably 50% of the artists we show live in the greater New York metropolitan area. So being here, we're part of that conversation that goes on in the city. But we are an alternative, and, being in the location we are, I think we increasingly try to capitalize on that we're in a suburban community, we're in a historic district, relatively small New England town. We have a landscape around here that we could do things outdoors. We don't have a huge piece of property. It's 3.5 acres that the museum sits on. But the landscape and the historical nature of the community actually interests a lot of artists in terms of, especially if you're approaching them to do a new project. I mean, we're working right now. Next year, 2014, is the 50th anniversary of the museum. And we're acknowledging in a number of different ways. But one of the things we're doing is borrowing notable historical objects that Larry Aldrich, the museum's founder, collected in the first decade of the museum's existence, the 1964 to 1974 period, which was kind of defining period for this museum in terms of setting the course of supporting primarily emerging and mid-career contemporary artists. We're borrowing back historical objects that Larry Aldrich collected, and significant things. We're talking about works by Richard Serra, Eva Hesse, Robert Morris, Richard Archschwager, Robert Rauschenberg, and there are two semesters of exhibitions in the next year, and each semester will have a handful of historical objects that we've borrowed. But playing off against those are a series of new projects by contemporary artists who we're working with because their work is somehow in the lineage of that work and owes a debt either to a specific artist or even perhaps to movement or the decade itself. I mean, the shadow of minimalism hangs so heavy over so much art making still. And, Larry Aldrich was a great champion of minimalist work in the mid and late 60s. And so the artists we're working with are artists that actually are interested in some of these historical figures. For instance, Robert Smithson, we're borrowing two pieces, including piece that was Smithson made at the museum out of gravel from the property. And it's the first instance in the museum's history of an artist actually making something here. And this is 1968. So something was created and destroyed here, which, in the 60s, that was like kind of a new and radical idea. And now we kind of take it for granted that artists will make something and it'll be destroyed. But we brought in to be in dialogue with Smithson, the artist Michael Jew, who lives in New York City, who Smithson has been a significant influence on his work, who will be doing a new project, major new project, which is kind of in response to some of Smithson's ideas, particularly about the landscape and the relationship between indoors and outdoors. And in the case of Michael, we've given him a space, and he's aware of these Smithson pieces and the nature of them and the historical importance of them. And his project has really been based on kind of thinking about Smithson and how Smithson's shadow still, is hangs over the art world in a major way. And it's he's not doing something that's an homage, certainly, but talking about historical continuity. And Michael has been given pretty much free rein here. There are budget constraints, but we've invited him to do this project, and he's putting together something that is going to be really pretty spectacular. That owes a debt to Smithson, but is very much his own work, and it's an example of the way. It's an example of the way we'll bring an artist to the museum to do something. In this case, acknowledge the history of the museum, but in a unique way. Instead of, we could have done the 50th anniversary with just, greatest hits of over 50 years. But because we're so much about the present or looking forward, we have the historical component, but, the majority of the exhibitions and programming next year will be with living artists who are, involved in some sort of dialogue with that first decade of the museum's existence.
Really exciting. Yeah, that seems to me to typify the sort of out-of-the-box thinking, which is why I guess you must have given that example. It's that's exciting to hear. I look forward to seeing that, and that'll open up when?
The anniversary, it's a year long, and it actually starts on Sunday, April 6th. And there are two major openings. The first semester of the anniversary, as I say, opens on April 6th, and it runs until September 21st. And the second semester begins on October 19th and runs until April 5th of 2015. The actual anniversary, it's interesting, the museum actually opened to the public in November of 2014. So we've kind of centered this kind of acknowledgement of the anniversary on that date. So it goes from 2014 into 2015.
Hmm. Interesting. I'd like to move a little bit backwards now and talk about your career and beginnings in the art, because it's interesting how you came to this position, which seems to be a wonderful place for a curator, being involved on a number of levels, and in many ways, I don't know what your ambitions are, but having done what you're doing, it's also what can lead to being directors of museums or opening up your own institution. How did you first get involved in the arts? Do you remember as a child or before school?
Well, the thing is, and I don't know if you're aware of this, that I'm actually a practicing artist too. Did you know that?
I didn't know that.
And many people think there are two Richard Kleins. And I have a my practice as an artist goes back much further than my working in the museum world, but I make work and exhibit work, and it's a huge part of my life, and it informs what I do working inside an institutional environment. And I think having a background not in art history or curatorial studies, but in the making of things, it alters the nature of the way I do my job here at the museum. And I think it, on some levels, it's very helpful working with artists on new projects and creative problem solving. And my practice is pretty varied from, I'm nominally considered a sculptor. I do a variety of things. I do writing independent of my job here at the museum, some critical writing and writing for, outside the museum for particularly for publications, and
the writing is on fields that don't relate specifically to curatorial practice.
Well, you know, I define myself in kind of really unusual terms, that a lot of what I do is a little bit offset from traditional practice. I mean, just to give you an example, I'm writing an article for Cabinet magazine that will appear next year that is somewhere between writing an article about sculpture and kind of humankind's interest in found objects in a peculiar way, and speculative archaeology. So it's a crazy hybrid project which involves scholarship but also kind of critical thinking about the nature of found objects, and particularly in Western culture versus traditional cultures. And you know, it's hard to say what that is. Is it an art project I'm doing for Cabinet, or is it a scholarly article? It's somewhere between the two of them. And I think a lot of what I do as a curator is in a similar position, where I'm doing scholarship on one level, and I certainly write for all the exhibitions that I do here at the Aldrich, but working with artists, there's a creative part of it that, you know, I'm kind of in some ways a collaborator with many of the artists we do projects on here, in terms of everything from feeding them information to making practical recommendations for their project. And, you know, as we said at the beginning of this conversation, fundraising and creative engagement with communities, bringing unusual groups or outside entities to collaborate with artists. I mean, with the Michael Jew project, we're trying to, he's going to be using lasers, and there's a company here in Connecticut that makes lasers for the defense industry that we're trying to have Michael actually, you know, get the lasers from. And so, you know, I've kind of interjected myself in the conversation with the corporate world about working with an artist. And it's an interesting conversation. I mean, I don't know. It's very positive so far. I don't know where it's leading, though.
What's interesting, that is, and it's exciting to talk about your art and that conversation in the corporate world. I was talking with, interviewing the director of Performa not long ago, Rosalie Goldberg, and I was asking her about how she basically sold Performa to corporate clients who had no idea what was going on there. And you know, I mean, a lot of big corporations who typically don't support the arts, she had gotten to support the arts, and it's one thing supporting an exhibition at a museum, it's another thing supporting Performa, which is something that most people don't get at all. And she said, I tell them, you may not understand what we're doing or what's going on here, but I can tell you, if you support this, when this is over, you will learn something and you will be changed somehow. And I thought that was wonderful. I mean, she talked about how she went to exhibits in the 70s, and she said she would leave those exhibits and feel, I mean, certainly not all of them, but had this idea, this somewhat romantic notion of leaving a show and feeling really changed somehow, that it altered the way you were looking at the world in a profound way, and that was part of her development pitch too.
Going out into the business world, there's such a you know, the business world is stratified. I mean, we're sometimes I will be going to the local lumber yard to ask for a donation of $2,000 worth of 2x4s for something that someone wants to build. Then the other hand, I'm going to major, you know, corporation X and asking, you know, for sponsorship for a project. And the pitch, as you say, in the corporate world is so much based on kind of experience and how you're buying into experience and connecting. You know, it has to do, the corporate world looks at so many, you know, investments in culture as being part of their branding of, you know, wanting to be adventuresome and to project an attitude of you know, being progressive and, like you say, experience, providing experience for the public, but also for their employees, where a lot of times, you know, we do have a corporate relationship, and the relationship is not just funding. It has to do with the employees coming here. We've done things with corporations where they have retreats here, actually. Senior staff come here and do brainstorming and get a tour of the exhibitions with the idea that, the experience of the museum and talking to all of us about contemporary art is something that will spur creativity inside their organizations. It goes two ways. I mean, we learn things from them, too. I don't want to say that's a one-way street. Certainly now, with everything being more, the nonprofit world being more geared towards kind of a business model, I think, nonprofit leaders and administrators can learn a lot from the corporate world. It goes both ways.
Absolutely. It's fascinating. Now it's really coming together for me, and I'm sorry, I didn't know your history as an artist, but now it's really coming together to me how your practice as a curator, as a writer, and an artist are kind of hybrid of how all those things influence each other. Your art practice is informing your curatorial practice and vice versa. It sounds like it's really something that is part of what seems to me a very vital life in terms of your own intellectual activity in the art world and in the realm of thinking about the arts and art making.
Well, hybrid I think is a good word, but the thing that I'm motivated by is curiosity. I hate being bored, and for that reason, the range of things I have done in my career kind of really pretty extraordinarily broad. And the downside of this is because I'm motivated by curiosity, I'm not motivated by profit. I can't say that I a lot of the things I've done have been lucrative, but I'm never bored. And that to me is the payoff. And I think that to me is the why one goes into the arts at all is wanting that kind of stimulation, needing that kind of intellectual stimulation and emotional stimulation. I'm certainly, I get paid for a lot of the things I do, but it's not called a nonprofit world for nothing.
Right. Well, let's move back a little bit. I just want to trace your so your career is you started off as a painter, and did you go to
no sculptor? I was actually started. I always made sculpture, but it's such an odd thing where I ended up in my 20s teaching art in a private school, and I ended up becoming the head of the art department, and there was a certain point where I realized, like, if I continue doing this, I'm going to teach for the rest of my life, and having to make a decision about that and like what that meant, and realizing that, yeah, teaching is interesting, but it not really what maybe I want to do. And then kind of coming into the museum world here through the back door of actually coming in, not as a curator, but as an administrative assistant. This is many years ago. I've worked here over 20 years now. And when the museum was a much smaller entity, and kind of realizing with my background and my interests that this was a very interesting world to work in. And, I think one thing that's kept me here for such a long time was being in a relatively small institution that's focused of getting the satisfaction of knowing what one does makes a huge difference. And working with an incredibly talented group of colleagues here over the years. It's like I said, I've been here so long, I've seen a lot of people come and go. But, the museum, the people I work with and the nature of this place is so fascinating to me. And the fact that it's always reinventing itself is, kept it fresh for me. Because I'm never doing anything twice. I mean, there's certainly a yearly rhythm to the exhibition cycle, which is not too much different than the academic year cycle. I mean, we do call even the programming period semesters here, but there's always there's always new artists, there's always new challenges, there's always something on the horizon which is completely different than what I've done before. And like I say, I'm attracted to do things that I go into things quite often I don't completely understand. I think that's a motivating factor for me, wanting the process, the curatorial process, to be a learning experience where I find out something I didn't know. And, an example would be this very large project we did this past summer with the artist Allison Smith, where we gave her the front of the historical administration building here, which is, part of which dates to 1783 and is right smack dab in the middle of Ridgefield's historic district. We invited her to do a project here, primarily because her practice, over 15 years, has dealt with American history, and we thought it was an ideal artist to kind of engage a new space in the museum and engage the public. Well, we didn't know what she wanted to do when we went to her, and it turns out that she wanted to do a project focusing on fife and drum music and the history of fife and drum music, going back to its origins, interestingly enough, in the Ottoman Empire, which is something I certainly never knew. So over the course of a year and a half, I went from, knowing nothing about the fife and drum world and this history to getting to the point where I could, give an hour-long talk, very intelligent talk about the history of fife and drum music and its relationship for everything from warfare to entertainment to craftsmanship, the actual crafting of the instruments, to the social engagement of it, and worked with Allison for almost a 2-year period on this project, which involved incredible public outreach and involved collaboration with Connecticut's fife and drum community, and Connecticut is the center of fife and drumming in the United States, interestingly enough, and working with incredibly talented people from this community in the context of a contemporary art museum was just a really remarkable experience that, and now, like I said, I went into this knowing nothing, and now I'm this minor expert on fife and drum music, which is something, you asked me 10 years ago, what are the chances of the scholarship in this topic? It was like, what are you talking about? I know nothing about this. But, this is an example of the nature is you let the artist lead. You respect an artist's work. You work with them. You say, we want to do a project with you. What do you want to do? And there's a conversation back and forth that leads to some pretty astounding things. And I think the feelings you have about the museum are a result of that, of the fact is we're very artist-centric. Go ahead.
That makes sense now. No, that makes a lot of sense to me in terms of how I've perceived the museum and why I was wondering it seems so, anachronistic for a small independent museum to have such a sophisticated point of view on contemporary art, and it's much, that makes much more sense to me. Is your work being exhibited now? Is there anywhere we can see that at the moment?
I do. I have a show with Stefan Stoyanov Gallery, which is on Orchard Street in New York, and I'm having a show coming up later next year. Stefan usually has something of mine. I think he has a piece that in the gallery right now. I'm not sure if it's actually on the wall, but there is work there. But if any of your listeners are on Orchard Street, you could stop in the Stefan's Gallery and actually see something I make. The art side, there's a roller coaster with my involvement. I'm very project driven here at the museum, but also in my practice, in the studio practice. So there's a rhythm where, I'm not working towards a project, so the output from the studio will be pretty modest, and other times I gear up for projects where there's an enormous amount of work comes out. And thankfully, my job, I have a certain degree of flexibility here at the museum where I could, as long as I'm getting the things done, I could be flexible about when I'm here and what I'm doing. There's a huge advantage to that. One thing is that I've worked this way for such a long time, and I say work this way, I mean work kind of in the museum world and had a studio practice, that part of me, I'm extremely a gregarious person, and I actually would be driven crazy if I just worked by myself in the studio all the time. I need the kind of stimulation, and a lot of what I do here influences what I do in curious ways, in unpredictable ways, in terms of making art. It's very hard to predict. I think a huge thing is the writing I've done, institutional writing and critical writing I've done, have hugely influenced my practice as an artist. I think just bringing that kind of critical thinking into thinking about art made by other people has been, for me, really important in terms of just analyzing what I do and putting it in a kind of historical context and making me understand where I've been and where I'm going. I think that's a gift that this has given me, because, frankly, before I worked in the museum world, I didn't really write that much. That's something that I was kind of, you kind of have to, and that necessity, necessity breeds invention, or invention breeds necessity. I don't know which way you want to put it, but I think that that's a gift that working in kind of this environment has given me.
Well, it sounds, I interview a lot of other artists as well as curators, and what you're saying sounds a lot like what I hear from other artists, minor and major artists who, are basically doing it full-time, is the importance of having a constant conversation going. And they're talking about often friends, talking to friends about their art, but what you're talking about is that as well, it seems to me, only even more magnified, because you're also an artist and you're involved in building your own exhibitions in that world. At the same time, you're writing and involved in what is, arguably a very academic setting, the museum, and it's creating conversations on all levels about art. So it's far from being isolated. You actually are surrounded by an enormous amount of intellectual and aesthetic stimulation from these variety of resources, as you just said, which promote,
those things. I just learn an enormous amount, because particularly talking in depth to, to younger people who are starting their careers, or I'm always curious what is someone who's 22 years old or 24 years old, what are they looking at? I want to know,
right.
What kind of music are they listening to? What art are they looking, what historical exhibition have they seen that's turned them on? Not just what Chelsea Gallery show is interested to them, but what have they seen that's historical?
Well, what apps have they downloaded as well?
Right.
Part of it. I interviewed Chrissy Isles from the Whitney Museum, and she was talking about, similar to what you're saying, talking to a lot of younger artists, and she said so much of it is, we're in this culture of Instagram and exchanging an enormous amount of images, that a lot of it is about, oh, did you see this on Instagram? Did you see this YouTube video? Did you see this?
That's a challenge now. Is the choices in terms of where one gets one information is so vast, and you have to make choices. You have to edit it down in terms of where you look and what you read, and what websites you go to, and what social media one gets involved in. And it's a complicated thing, because you can't do everything. And there's this still, the time taken up with good old fashioned socializing one-on-one. There's a rhythm to this, but doing, studio visits is a huge part of what I do. In fact, I did a studio visit in New Haven last week.
It's been fascinating talking with you today, and I'm really appreciative of your time, and I think it's so exciting how you mix together different fields of interest. In closing, is there something you want to say to artists who are listening to this, who are not only working in multiple genres, they're far from just graduate students, they're at all levels of their career, and most likely all over the world. Is there anything you want to leave with them in terms of artistic practice? I know you've probably piqued a lot of interest in this interview just about the kind of conversation that you've generated for yourself and the very special way the museum works with artists. Is there anything else you want to say to them in closing?
I think, you know, if I'm going to say something that's advice to artists, I just think, you know, don't turn down any opportunity to have the power more than ever before to create opportunities and to not depend on outside entities. It's like, really the power of whether it's doing things on your website, unusual projects that really, are different than just what you might do in the studio, thinking about the medium of your website itself, or, you know, getting together with a couple friends and taking over a storefront for a month to do your own exhibition. I just think it's an era of opportunity, and don't be passive is to create opportunities. And it's amazing to me. Just it seems like the cultural interest now in contemporary art is at this all-time high, and it's a lot of it is fogged by the commodification, the increasing commodification of art, which there's good and bad things about it. But it's just, I think, generationally in my lifetime, there's been a change where there's an enormous number of people interested in art now, much more than when I was younger. And I think that people who are educated grew up, people who are particularly under 40, like thinking that, art is important, contemporary art is important. And and I think that's a sea change. I mean, it's not this kind of specialized thing anymore, where people are very aware, and contemporary things happening in contemporary art world make general news now, and people are interested in the nature of contemporary art. And the fact is that, so much contemporary art, as I was saying before, is involved in public engagement of one sort or another. So artists are going out and affecting the world and affecting communities, and some artists are even, in terms of social practice, are doing things that are way outside the gallery, the kind of commercial gallery world, but, doing things that are making differences in communities. I'm very impressed, for instance, with, the kind of resurgence in the art community out in Detroit, with the Detroit falling apart as a city, yet how many people have been drawn out there because of the potential of what a place like Detroit could be. I think, art is a very powerful thing and continues to be in our culture. And it's always hard to predict where and how it's going to make a difference, but it does. And I believe in that. And that's what keeps me going. That's a nice way. That's kind of a good way to summarize, huh?
It is. Thank you so much for talking to us today. I'm really grateful for this talk.
Well, Brainerd, it's been a pleasure.
You're listening to Yale Radio WIBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the Art World Demystified.